The war with Iran is over. Or is it? President Trump has declared victory in the 12-day war and brought Israel and Iran to a ceasefire, but what next? Meanwhile, Europe prepares for war at a critical NATO summit, and Russia helps China get ready to fight. We're going to look at this and more on today's Trumpet World. Well, we have peace of a sort in the Middle East. On Saturday night, President Trump launched an attack against Iran using America's bunker buster bombs against their nuclear facility in Fordo, before then pushing for a ceasefire a few days later. As the dust settles, metaphorically and literally, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic. First, Mihailo, what can you tell us about the attack that we saw over the weekend?
On Sunday morning, Iran time, the United States had a fleet of B-2 bombers, its most advanced bomber, fly all the way from the Midwest of the U.S. across halfway around the world, refueling mid-flight, and drop 14 bunker busters, those GBU-57 bombs, most powerful non-nuclear bombs in the world, on two Iranian nuclear sites, with a third one attacked in a different way. Fordo, as you mentioned, that approximately 300 feet below ground enrichment facility that no other ordnance can penetrate, as that had 12 bombs dropped on top of it. People have been saying before this that in order for an attack to be successful, you needed to have two bombs launched on exactly the same spot just to reach down there. And apparently President Trump thought two wasn't enough, so he dropped 12. Two other ones were dropped over Natanz. That's the more widely production-capable facility that Israel had already bombed. I guess the United States went to finish the job. As well as the there was another facility at the city of Isfahan that was hit by Tomahawk cruise missiles. It is also an underground facility. The Tomahawks weren't able to actually penetrate that facility, but there were some facilities above ground that were used in, say, helping create the technology for enrichment that were hit, that were critical to Iran's supply chain.
So then the next step after this attack was to push for a ceasefire. So, I mean, what can you tell us about that and about the state that Iran was left in at the end of that, and where we are now with relations between Iran and Israel and America?
Well, of course, Iran, everyone was expecting Iran to give some sort of retaliation after this. On Monday, they gave the retaliation against the United States, and it was very clearly staged. They attacked the Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, the United States' main logistical hub for the Middle East. They told the Qataris that they were going to do this in advance, who told the Americans knowingly. It was very much preempted, intercepted. Nobody was hurt or injured.
Yeah, it was kind of like the bare minimum Iran needed to at least save face and say they did something.
Exactly. And the fact that they were talking into Qatar, we've spoken before in this program on how they're in league with the Islamists too. They have a pretty strong relationship with Iran. So this is very much organized between friends as just a, like you said, a face-saving measure. With Israel, there was much more extensive damage, including most notably an attack on the southern Israeli city of Beersheba, including a hospital where four people unfortunately died. When you hear Iran talking ahead of the Qatar attack, they were saying, we were only attacking a military target. We're trying to keep this within the laws of war. And then they go hit a hospital in Israel. Apparently, every citizen of Israel counts as a military target there, which goes to show you the double standard of people, both of Iran, but also of people accusing Israel of doing this when they're being attacked by the with the same attacks. But I digress with that. But as you mentioned, with that, soon after that, President Trump had said he had organized a ceasefire between Israel and Iran. Iran violated the ceasefire immediately with several missiles that were intercepted into Israeli airspace. Israel responded by attacking Iranian targets, including, I believe, a radar station. And President Trump, for his part, apparently was blindsided by this. And he gone on the phone with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We don't know the exact details of what he said, but considering he famously cursed Israel in front of the news cameras, we can assume that what was said behind closed doors was even worse. And Israel reverted course. To this point, we have not had any major Israeli or Iranian attacks. Israel has bragged that its Mossad agents are still on the ground and they're still preparing for what happens next. But at this point, it looks like the ceasefire is, to a very limited technical degree, still holding.
So that brings us to the kind of tricky discussion as to how much did this war accomplish. And I think it's tricky because everybody describing this comes at this with ideological baggage. So there's been the leak to CNN and the New York Times that said this only set back Iran's... So there's been the leak to CNN, to the New York Times, that says this only set back Iran's nuclear program by, quote, months. There have been reports coming out of Israel that are more optimistic, that have said it set it back by 2 years. The cynic in me says you call 2 years months if you're trying to make it sound like a shorter period of time. And so maybe these two pieces of intelligence are reflecting the same thing. I think in evaluating this, we have to avoid falling for the kind of the Trump derangement syndrome side of things that wants to make anything that Donald Trump does sound like a failure. And you've got kind of the same analysts on CNN that before the strike were saying that Iran was a million years away from having a bomb are now saying after the strike, Iran is still months away from having the bomb. And they're quite clearly just reflexively, you know, opposing Donald Trump. At the same time, the Mullah regime is still there in Iran. The hatred of America is still there in Iran. The death to Israel, the death to America chants are still there. The desire to work with terrorist groups is still there. This is still an avowed enemy of Israel and of the United States. Its capacity to hurt Israel and the United States has been degraded. Exactly how much then, I guess, is debatable. But they're still there. And so I think this has done a lot of damage to Iran. And Donald Trump has grasped with the real problem of radical Islamist terror in a way that no other president, I think, even including George W. Bush, has. Some of these people, they went after Afghanistan, they went after Iraq. We've been saying all along, Iran is the head of the snake. Iran is the key to sponsoring all of these groups. And nobody has dared mess with Iran until President Trump. So I think he deserves credit for that. So he's done a lot to hurt Iran, but a lot isn't enough. And that with that hatred, that will to strike at Israel and the United States, we will still see Iran be incredibly dangerous, even if they have to go away and lick their wounds for a time.
Indeed, and a few other caveats. If you listen to basically any source out there, including the various intelligence agencies in the U.S., they'll all give a different estimate on what they think this happened, what they think that happened. Fordo, as mentioned, is underground. These bunker buster bombs are meant to hit targets underground. All we have is satellite imagery showing that there are holes in the ground, and until people actually come in and look there, we can't actually be certain what happened. With that being said, I think one of the more, I don't like calling them the United Nations this, but one of the more impartial observers of this is the International Atomic Energy Agency. Not because they have people on the ground there, they're immediately evicted as soon as all these attacks happen, but because they've seen a lot of these facilities beforehand, they have some idea what the technology is and that what their sensitivities are. And they've been pretty cautiously affirmative that whatever happened, even if it didn't hit, say, the centrifuges themselves, it would have hit, say, their power supplies, or even just some of the environmental conditions caused by these bombs would have been enough to damage them.
Yeah, I think we can be confident of a few things. One is centrifuges are very delicate pieces of equipment. And so even if Fordo is intact and the roof hasn't fallen in and collapsed, those centrifuges are very probably out of operation. Another of the big questions is Iran had 400 kilograms of uranium enriched to 60% enrichment. And enrichment scales of uranium it's not kind of this linear scale. It's not like, okay, it's 60% enriched. It's 60% of the way there, just more than half of the work has been done. It's a lot more than 60% of the way to the bomb. Most of the hard work in preparing that uranium to be equipped in a bomb is done. What happened to that? And that's a big unknown at this point. There was images of trucks leaving Fordo. It seems quite likely Iran would have spread that around. At the same time, we got a whole lot of very busy Israeli strikes. Was it Monday night, right after the ceasefire was announced? You know, it wouldn't surprise me if some of what Israel was doing was tracking and then going after some of that uranium. So I think it would be, we don't have enough facts to say it's still blowing in the wind. Equally, we don't have enough facts to say that's still taken care of. And if there's bits of that uranium still out there, that leaves Iran still pretty close to developing a bomb.
And well, going back to the IAEA report, they have also said that they have not detected any atmospheric radiation released from the strikes of those sites, which, if the storage units in those sites were damaged, if somehow that material was escaped, you would be able to detect that pretty easily. This is a quote here from a Telegraph article that speaks a little bit of those lorries with citing unnamed sources. Quote, "Before the strike, 16 lorries were seen queuing up outside Fordo, and an expert on Iran's nuclear program told the Telegraph the regime had moved much of its highly enriched uranium to a secret location before the U.S. was able to bomb its facilities. Tehran had hidden sites housing, quote, hundreds if not thousands of advanced centrifuges capable of producing weapons-grade uranium needed for a nuclear bomb," said Seema Shine, who has worked with within the Israeli military establishment for 30 years, end quote. Where are all these secret sites? Well, we might have another idea of that, in that there is a fourth nuclear site that the United States hasn't actually touched. Officially, it hasn't been opened yet. It's called Pickaxe Mountain. That's obviously a translation of the Persian. But it's right next to Natanz site, the big one that both Israel and the U.S. struck. It's deeper than Fordo. How deep, we don't exactly know. And the mountainous terrain it's built in, just the geography itself, the topography, makes it harder for these bunker buster bombs to actually hit a proper place where they could burrow in deep down. Again, there's very, very little about this site we know. According to Iran, it hasn't even opened yet. When Rafael Grossi, the director general of the IAEA, asked Iran what's going on there, the response he got was, I quote, "It's none of your business." So whatever's going down there, it sounds pretty important. For all we know, we could have something the scale of Fordo already operating down there and everything moved over there. And the fact that it hasn't even been touched by the U.S. military, if we're finding about this right now, you could be sure Israel and the U.S. both knew about this long ago. So the fact that it hasn't even been touched, maybe it means they know that it's not operational, it's not a worry, or maybe it just flew completely under their radar, no pun intended, and that Iran still has capability to take all that enriched uranium. People estimate it can make up to 9 or 10 bombs with the amount it already has and convert those into 9 or 10 bombs.
Now, fundamentally, you know, we're not here because of our expertise in analyzing fissile material and nuclear weapons programs. We're bringing world news based on Bible prophecy. And you know, Jesus Christ himself came as a newscaster. He came giving the advanced news of the coming kingdom of God. And he gave a lot of specific prophecies about events that would precede the setting up of the kingdom of God and his return to the earth. And he referenced Daniel the prophet and said, well, you need to understand these prophecies in the Old Testament as well. And he told Christians to watch and pray. And so you know, we're going over this news to help you do that. And so we're focused on this from the perspective of Bible prophecy. And we have been saying throughout this war, expect an anti-US, anti-Israel, belligerent, radical Islamist Iran to continue in some form. Okay, maybe there's still regime change. Maybe, like, there's a lot of details that could change, but that's the overall big picture. And that is because of prophecies for the time of the end in Daniel chapter 11 and that talk about a clash between the King of the North and the King of the South. And even since the early 90s, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flores identified Iran as the King of the South. And here's a clip from A Key of David that he gave all the way back in 1993.
So the King of the South must arise after Daniel was revealed. These verses point to a King of the South that is yet future. And I believe all indications point to radical Islam headed by Iran as this king. The King of the North is guided by a great religion, and it appears the King of the South is also. That is probably the only way they can unite anyhow. That is religion bringing them together.
Now, there's a lot of good evidence to show that Iran is fulfilling that role. And we covered a lot of that. We had a whole special edition where we spent the entire show showing how Iran is the King of the South, why Iran is the King of the South, where this is leading. And Mr. Flurry talked about Iran being the King of the South, you know, all the way through the early 90s, all the way through the time where, well, Iraq was the big focus in the news, and then Afghanistan. And guided by that Bible prophecy, he's focused on, well, watch for the role that Iran plays. Watch for them to be the pushy nation, the nation that really drives events in the Middle East. And so that's been our forecast throughout this. Now it's looking pretty clear that, well, it's very clear that Iran is going to continue in that role, and that even, okay, maybe we might be seeing the end of the career of this particular Ayatollah, perhaps. He's certainly getting up there in age, but this Islamist regime is set to continue. So, you know, briefly, what does Bible prophecy tell us about what to expect here, and how does that tie into what we've seen this week?
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. You referenced Daniel 11, verse 40 specifically says, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, the king of the north, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, etc., etc. You keep reading on to the prophecy. It talks about a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. That's in Daniel 12, verse 1. It's a worldwide catastrophe, and we have plenty of literature correlating with other prophecies showing that this is a nuclear world war. And it starts with a push from Iran, from this king of the south. It starts with Iran basically lighting the fuse that throws everything in the world upside down. We've seen the United States attack the nuclear program now. It looks like that Iran has been perhaps not as primed to launch this kind of push that we're expecting to throw the world into nuclear world war just yet. But as we mentioned, there are still avenues Iran could use to make a nuclear bomb. That uranium is still unaccounted for. And especially at this moment, when they know that Israel and to some degree America has the will to go after the nuclear program, I'd like to say, even with all the good things that these strikes have done, certainly it's a lot more, as you said, than other presidents have done, Iran now has extra incentive to convert that 60% into 90%, which, as he mentioned, is not that difficult to do. When you see a wounded animal like this, the first thing they're going to do is to make sure they have some leverage now to go after Israel and the United States. And Mr. Flurry has specified that he expects this push, this provocation, and you can look into the Hebrew, it means to gore with a horn as if with an animal, to be nuclear. This is a quote from his free book, The King of the South. Quote, "No other nuclear power thinks like that. It makes nuclear war inevitable. All the wishful thinking in this world won't stop that calamity, just as the pacifist dreamers of the 1930s didn't stop Adolf Hitler. Jesus Christ prophesied the outcomes of these problems in Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. He said the coming great tribulation would be worse than any in mankind's long tragic history. He warned that unless these perilous days were shortened, no flesh would be saved alive. Passages like this and Daniel 12, verse 1 describe a time of such catastrophic destruction that they could only apply to weapons of mass destruction." Then further down, he says, "Only nuclear weapons could cause that. Sadly, shamefully, we've brought this outcome upon ourselves. Nuclear war, provoked by the King of the South, is coming upon the whole world very soon." End quote. So one way or another, we still expect Iran to obtain the bomb. And again, when you see them being provoked like this, they're not going to back down at this point. Maybe they wanted to de-escalate with the United States. Again, they still hit Israel quite severely. They still see Jerusalem as the holy city they need to liberate from the infidels. They still have their motivation and extra motivation to keep doing what they're doing and then some. So with these prophecies in mind, and even just with the facts on the ground, you could expect a more belligerent, bellicose Iran to keep pushing, to keep seeing how far they could go in accomplishing their goals.
Certainly in the long run, I think perhaps over the next little bit, we might see a more subdued, compliant Iran as it just tries to survive and not bring the wrath of Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu down on its heads again. But we're still going to see, you know, exactly those aims, even if those aims are perhaps disguised for a short amount of time. And I think the other interesting fact about Daniel 11 and those verses after verse 40 is it says, well, the king of the north, this European superpower, is going to attack the king of the south and also Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia, implying that Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia are allied with the king of the south. And so as Iran seeks to rebuild their power, its power in Syria and Lebanon, a lot of that has been crippled. And so it's going to work instead to set up a new power base in North Africa. And we've been forecasting this shift in strategy because of that, you know, for a long time. So even this setback ties right in with Bible prophecy. And so ultimately, you know, God is going to use Iran as part of the curses, the punishments on this world for disobedience, for going in a way of life that's contrary to God's law, and a way of life ultimately that leads to suffering and disaster. And this is part of God's correction. And so this evil regime has survived. It will sustain a little longer, but it's also leading to the time then that Jesus Christ returns, that deals with the king of the north and the king of the south, that deals with human nature, and that brings in that wonderful kingdom of God ruling over the earth and bringing peace and joy and happiness. And that's the context that we've got to see all of this in. And our free book, The King of the South, talks about, will help you prove that Iran is the king of the south, and helps put all of this in that critical context. And you can get that free book on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'll put a link to it in the show notes as well. Did you have any other stories from the Middle East you wanted to bring to us today?
One that's related, but going in a different direction. Because of all these things we just talked about, there are people in Iran trying to figure out how best to basically tell the world that's still relevant. And Iran's parliament, which is not the final authority on most things in Iran, but it's still a government body, they voted on Monday to close off the Strait of Hormuz, which is that narrow waterway connecting the Persian Gulf to the Indian Ocean. Essentially, they're saying they're going to be putting a blockade on oil and natural gas leaving Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and some of these other countries from going to the rest of the world and trade. They probably won't follow through with that.
Right. Iran's parliament's a pretend parliament, isn't it? It's there to give the country the illusion of democracy.
Mm-hmm. The mullahs, as you mentioned, they need to sign off on anything like that, and they haven't done it. And if they were to do it, they'd kill their own economy because they rely on the oil exports as much as the other countries do.
And it would be a declaration of all-out war with the United States. I think that's not something they would do until they are ready to kind of go full catastrophe and push on everybody.
That's true. But at the same time, we've also expected Iran to have control over these more critical sea gates. We've seen Iran use that leverage, say with the Bab al-Mandeb Strait and their Houthi proxies. The Strait of Hormuz, they directly border that. And it's also been having a few ripple effects in the rest of the world, which we'll probably put up at some point an article about how China is looking at this. China is the main customer of Iran. They get 90% of their oil. Iran sends 90% of its oil to China. But if the Strait of Hormuz closes, then they're going to have to start looking for alternative buyers. And there's been rumblings. The Wall Street Journal had an article that they're going to become more and more dependent on Russia for energy, which is another trend we're expecting. But that's a whole other region that maybe Jeremiah Jacques might have more to say about that.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. Also, this week we had a very significant NATO summit. This was President Trump's first kind of in-person summit with NATO since his re-election. All eyes were on what would happen here. Really, the outcome was decided a few weeks ago, but we got a summit that saw Europe commit to dramatically step up its military spending. Now, by doing that, they have convinced President Trump to remain in NATO. There was a bit of flattery there. This particular clip kind of went, is the most viral moment from that summit.
Let him fight for about 2-3 minutes, then it's easier to stop him.
And then daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
You have to use strong language. Every once in a while, you have to use a certain word.
The White House then lent into that quite heavily, putting out almost a music video of Donald Trump's highlights from the clip with the songs, with the lyrics like Daddy's Home or something like that, going over the top of it. The media continually asked about this. And in some ways, it's some silliness that overshadows the real meaning of this trip. And that is this new commitment from Europe, from NATO members, to spend more on their defense. The summit's conclusion was short. It was 424 words compared to 11,000 a couple of years ago. But in that short conclusion, it states that allies will allocate at least 3.5% of GDP annually based on the agreed definition of NATO defense expenditure by 2035. So over the next 10 years, they will, Europe, all of NATO has said, well, we're going to spend 3.5% of our economy on our military. And then there's another 1.5% of GDP annually to, quote, protect our critical infrastructure, defend our networks, ensure our civil preparedness and resilience, unleash innovation, and strengthen our defense industrial base. Basically, it's so broad that it's meaningless, and NATO members will be able to count whatever they want almost as part of that 1.5%. And that brings it up to this nice 5% figure that kind of they can put a bow on and present to the world, as we agreed, 5% defense spending. And that seems pretty impressive. But really, the figure is 3.5%. And that is very significant to have Europe spending that. And also, we saw Germany putting in place their or unveiling their budget for the next term of this parliament. They've got their new government, and they're moving the most quickly towards this 3.5% target. So their defense spending is going to hit 2.4% of their GDP this year, and they're going to be spending a whole lot of money, and they're aiming to meet that 3.5% target in 2029. So they're not waiting for 10 years' time, which is when NATO says they have to reach it. They're getting there a whole lot quicker, and they're planning to spend 177 billion of their, $177 billion on their military. And that really is a huge change for Germany. I know it's easy to get lost in throwing out millions and billions, but back in 2015, Germany was spending about $40 billion on its military. Last year, it was more than double. Last year, it was up to about 100 billion. Now they're talking about reaching almost 200 billion by the end of the decade. You know, a fourfold increase, 400%. Like, these are not just 10, these are not little increases. Germany is going to be spending in 1 year as much as it used to spend in four. It is very rapidly militarizing. And one of the big takeaways from this is it's really cementing Germany as the leader of Europe, because other European countries aren't able to boost their military spending that quickly. I mean, Spain has basically said, we are going to ignore this 3% target. We're not going to meet it. And Donald Trump is not happy about that. He's promised to put double tariffs on Spain as to whatever he agrees for the rest of the European Union. So they're going to have to fight that out with President Trump there. It's also picking a fight with Donald Trump has stabilized the Spanish political system, because it's gained their prime minister a lot more popularity. But you know, they're not good. They said they're not going to do it. France and Italy, it's hard to see how they can do it. France is kind of scratching its head. They're looking at kind of coming up with some accounting shenanigans so that they can borrow more money to be able to meet this, but both of these countries are close to maxing out their credit card. Germany isn't. Germany has been quite frugal, which is how they can ramp up this spending very quickly. So not only is Europe rapidly spending more money thanks to this NATO summit, but it's also the fact that Germany can afford to ramp up this fast is really cementing them as the military heart of Europe. Here's that clip from Mr. Armstrong that that we used to play so many times. I think we still do quite a bit on the Trumpet Daily radio show.
And some of us, my friends, know not only what we see when we're over there, but we know also what is prophesied. And we know what is prophesied to rise up in Europe. And we know which is the one and the only nation in Europe that is capable of dominating, and which is the economic and the industrial heart of all Europe, without which there could be no stability and strength. A human body cannot live without its heart. And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
And we're really seeing that now Germany is, for a long time, Germany has been content to only be the economic heart of Europe and to dominate Europe through its economy. And it's done a whole lot to do that. But now we're seeing it shift and translate that economic dominance into military dominance. And so it's going to absolutely dominate in terms of military spending. And that's going to have major shifts in terms of where weapons are produced, where they're bought, because Germany will hold the purse strings. It will be Germany calling the shots on what Europe does. I mean, they're already NATO's second largest military spender. And then also we're seeing it in things like Germany's deployment to Lithuania, where they're sending troops there. This is the subject of this week's Key of David program, Lithuania in Prophecy, which I'd really urge you to go and watch. We've talked about this troop deployment to Lithuania quite a bit on this show, but Mr. Flory really sets it up in its epic sweep and shows you how important this is. It puts it in context with why how this gets nations looking to Germany in a special way, but also the history that was ignored by the German and Lithuanian leaders as they held this big ceremony to open up this permanent military stationing. You know, the way that Lithuania was quite happy to work with the Nazis in World War II with the Holocaust. And despite all of that history, Germany is moving back in. Here's just a quick taster from that Key of David.
If you look at that 44th Armored Brigade, they are now in Lithuania, and they're going to stay there permanently. That's not good news. That tells you that Germany is beginning to reach out and take over another country. And they're going to do that to more countries, and they're going to lead 10 kings. They're going to cause all kinds of problems in the area surrounding them, and they're going to start World War III. Now, I'll show you a scripture where it shows you that. There are many of them.
So I'd really encourage you, go and watch that. The Key of David show, it's on its own channel, The Key of David, on Rumble, on YouTube. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. And again, we can put a link to that show. And Mr. Flory has an article as well on that, in our upcoming Trumpet print edition. There is also a whole lot about Iran in the upcoming Trumpet print edition. So please be sure that you subscribe to that. You can go on our website again, thetrumpet.com, and you can subscribe and you can get the Trumpet print through your mailbox. Every month or 10 times a year, it comes out. And again, we're very happy to send that to you for free. There's no obligation. There's no follow-up. There's never any costs. All we do is after about 6 months, or I think it's 3 months after your first issue, we just send a little card saying, hey, if you're still reading this, if you still want this, let us know. We're happy to keep on sending it to you. But we just want to make sure we're not wasting your time and our time sending you something you don't want. But that's it in terms of follow-up. There'll be no pressure for donations or anything like that. So you can sign up for that on our website, thetrumpet.com, and you'll get the latest on Iran, the latest on Operation Rising Lion, the latest on Germany leading Europe, the latest on the NATO summit. All of that is in there. But very quickly, we're seeing Europe catapulted to the lead in Europe. And another story that relates to this is a pretty eye-opening survey that was published this week, where nearly two-thirds of Germans said they wanted Europe to have an independent nuclear deterrent. That was conducted by the Forsa Institute. 64% said they wanted to set up a Europe-wide nuclear shield, only 29% opposed. And what Deutsche Welle made an interesting observation on this survey, and they said that there is, quote, solid backing across age groups, regions, party lines, something rare in German foreign policy debates. This is an unusual level of consensus, and it doesn't matter whether it's left or right, young or old, a majority in just about all of these different subgroups is in favor of an independent nuclear deterrent. And so as you see Europe build up its military, they're also saying, well, we don't want to rely on the United States. And we don't want to rely on America's nuclear umbrella. We want to be able to do our own thing. Foreign Affairs pointed to this as well. They had an article on the NATO summit, Beware the Europe You Wish For, where they wrote, before American officials pat themselves on the back or take a victory lap, they must understand the downsides of their success. Growing European powers means the era of comfortable US leadership is over. Now that it provides more for itself, Europe will feel less pressure to defer to Washington's interests. It is less likely to buy American-made weapons. It might deny the United States the right to use American military bases in Europe for operations in Africa, Asia, and in the Middle East. Europe is splitting from America, and by encouraging them to spend more on their defense, yeah, I get the free rider, I get the frustration in America for Europe just having America take care of all of their security bills for them. But by encouraging Europe to develop its own military, they're going to separate from the United States. They're rising in power, and Germany is walking down the same history that it trod before in World War I and World War II. That history alone is a powerful warning about where this is leading. Bible prophecy adds an even more powerful warning that we're seeing the Holy Roman Empire rise back up, and not only is it going to split from the United States, it's going to turn on the United States. I mean, they're going to be the ones that ultimately deal with Iran, like we were just talking about, but they're not going to stop there either. Having gained that taste for power, they will launch a massive surprise attack on the United States too. And you know, Mr. Flurry's Key of David, Lithuania in Prophecy, will tell you a whole lot more about that. Well, that's about it for Europe. For our next section, we'll go to Andrew and get the latest stories from the English-speaking world.
Yeah, some big financial news in America this week. The dollar actually plummeted over 10% compared to the euro and other major currencies. And the plummet had nothing to do with the bombing of Iran. It actually had to do much more with something President Trump said at the NATO summit. On the sidelines of the NATO summit, people were asking about the interest rates for the Federal Reserve, and particularly about some of Donald Trump's disagreements with Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell. And Trump said, I know three or four people I'm going to pick. I mean, he's going to be out pretty soon, unfortunately, because I think he's terrible. So pretty much highlighting the fact that Trump has been pressuring Jerome Powell for months to cut interest rates. Jerome Powell's refused to do so because the Federal Reserve is an independent body. Trump can't actually fire him, and his term doesn't expire till May next year, which is pretty soon. But he's basically telling the NATO allies that he's not intending on replacing Jerome Powell. He wants to replace him with someone more in line with his own economic thinking. And there's actually even rumors going around Washington, D.C., that he may name Jerome Powell's successor well before May, just kind of in a bid to undermine him. And so the reasons this is causing the dollar to crash is really concerns over inflation. The Federal Reserve has basically has two mandates. Their two mandates is keep the inflation below 2% and keep unemployment below 4%. The Trump administration is making that very hard for them to do by passing legislation like the Big Beautiful Bill that's running $2 trillion deficits, which create more inflation. The Federal Reserve has no control over those deficits. So their only tool to keep the inflation below 2% is to raise the interest rates. Trump wants them cut to stimulate the American economy, but the inflation's still at 2.7%, so they don't want to do that. Trump's really telegraphing to our NATO allies and the world that he's going to try to pressure Jerome Powell out of office before next May, or at the latest, replace him with someone who will cut interest rates next May, which means lower interest rates are almost assuredly coming. But when you combine the lower interest rates Trump wants with the $2 trillion deficit he's pushing for, we're going to see a return to the inflation crisis in America sooner rather than later, probably sometime next year.
So clearly this would make it much easier for America to borrow money, make it easier for the government to borrow money more cheaply. Like you said, this will go straight into inflation. But I've also heard Jerome Powell say, I'm not going anywhere. What levers does the president have to push him out?
Very few, other than just public opinion. If he named his successor early, he might be able to turn public opinion and make Jerome Powell. He'd pretty much just have to make him get to the point where he doesn't want to deal with this anymore and resigns. But even beyond that, though, just the fact that Trump's saying these things shows that he is actively looking for a new Fed chairman who will cut the rates. And like I said, Jerome Powell's term, it does expire May 2026. So that's less than
so he's out
a year
by then
away,
anyway,
like 11 months. So in 11 months, his term's going to be up and Trump's going to appoint someone who will cut the rates. There's been rumors that if he can announce who he's going to appoint early, maybe he can just try to apply some pressure to get Jerome Powell to go do something else with his life. But if Jerome Powell does stick to his guns and says, I'm not going anywhere, there's no way to get rid of him before May, which, and normally, like I said, if in a case where, inflation's caused by inflating the money supply. And so right now, the biggest way that the government inflates the money supply is spending $2 trillion each year it doesn't have. So the problem here is, this gets back to Donald Trump's feud with Elon Musk and the big beautiful bill and the spending problem. The problem here is the government spending. If you could actually run a balanced budget, it wouldn't matter nearly as much if you slash the interest rates. Because what the Federal Reserve is trying to do here is if you're pumping all these new dollars into the economy, you're not creating wealth. You're just diluting the value of the dollar. So the Federal Reserve raises the interest rates with the idea to encourage people to take those dollars and put it in their own personal savings accounts. And so the dollars, they don't really create inflation if they're just sitting in a savings account, not circulating. And so that is that's basically how Jerome Powell, he is largely responsible for bringing the Biden inflation from 9% down to 2.7% now, is during COVID, the government printed tremendous amounts of money. I think one out of every $5 in circulation was put in circulation since COVID. They've just been using high interest rates to pull those dollars back out of circulations and stash them away in a CD or a savings account or a money market or something like that. So if Jerome Powell were to follow Donald Trump's advice and cut the interest rates, it would be cheaper to borrow money. Auto loans would come down. Mortgages would probably come down, which would provide some people with some relief. But you discourage the saving, and then you're going to get inflation back up again. And in a time right now between the big beautiful bill and the war with the the Federal Reserve, America's investors around the world are realizing that the dollar is losing value and it's not a good safe haven for wealth anymore. And that's largely behind why it fell 10% in relation to the euro. That 10%, that 10% doesn't mean like 10% inflation was created this week, because it's not the dollar measured against purchasing power. It's like the dollar measured against the euro, which means the euro's appreciating relative to the dollar, and making it seem like a more stable currency. And that's really the big prophetic angle we're looking for here. Is there's well over 100 prophecies in the Bible about a united Europe invading and conquering the United States. There's a couple prophecies in the Bible about debt problems in America and the end time. And so putting all those together, the late Herbert W. Armstrong's probably his greatest personal prophecy is he thought that the debt crisis in America would be the catalyst that causes Europe to unite. And so you're looking for a situation in the very new future where the euro, or at least whatever currency Europe's using at the time, replaces the dollar as the world's reserve currency. I've seen a number of analysts from within the European Union saying that Trump's tariffs and the fight over the Big Beautiful Bill, it's kind of opening up an opportunity for Europe to rush in and grab that reserve currency status by convincing the world that the euro's more stable than the dollar. Now, they have a lot of work to do that. They basically, the dollar's backed by one federal government, while the euro is backed by like 27, soon to be 28. No, that's European Union, sorry, that'd be. Eurozone is 17, soon to be 18, once Bulgaria officially joins national governments. So they have a lot of work. If they want to be the reserve currency, they need to start surrendering more and more authority to a pan-European government. But in the meantime, just by not printing money and running up debt, the euro is making quite a bit of progress at convincing people that it's a more stable currency than the dollar. And Donald Trump simultaneously pushing for a Fed rate cut and $2 trillion in deficit spending is definitely making it much easier for European officials to convince global investors that the dollar is not a safe investment.
And it reminds me of a story that's been building in the UK today, where we're in this absolutely bonkers position where the government hands out vast amounts of money to people that claim to have a disability. It's got to the point where 10% of Britain's working age population is on disability benefits. I mean, quite clearly, 10% of Britain's working age population are not too sick that they can't work normally. And another very large chunk of that, I think around a quarter, just claim it's mental disability. They've got nothing physically wrong with them, but they're getting free money from the government because they're anxious or depressed or something like that. In Northern Ireland, half of all new cars sold are new cars bought by the government to give free cars to people that are claiming disability benefit. Like half. And you know, most people can't afford a new car. But you claim disability benefits, the government will give you one. And it's so obviously completely unsustainable. And yet the Labour government, this left-wing government, they were going to start to try to deal with this. They had something in place to cut down just some of the bill. And they balked. The majority of the Labour Party rebelled against the Prime Minister, refused to support it, and it got massively watered down. And it's like, well, if we can't even take this small step to deal with a situation that is obviously bonkers, how are we ever going to get our debt under control? And then you see the United States with the debt at such a gargantuan level, and then all the effort is going to, hey, how do we get interest rates down, not how do we deal with this massive spending? And it really does make you think, is there anything, like, is anyone going to try and get a hold of this before it all just blows up? Because it really doesn't look like that. I mean, it really looks like both Britain and America are just heading for an inevitable massive explosion. And that's then exactly what you were talking about, and that Mr. Armstrong talked about for years, that financial crisis starting in America, probably caused by this massive debt, is going to then play a major role in Europe coming together, the creation of a new economic system led by the European Union, or at least a successor to the European Union, this 10-nation superstate. And I think it's looking more and more obvious that no government is going to take any of these opportunities to try and turn things around, and the explosion is going to happen.
Yeah, back in November, shortly after Trump was elected, I mean, he came out and made some big promises, putting Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy in charge of a new Department of Government Efficiency. And he talked about how they were going to work for 2 years, and on America's 250th anniversary, July 4th, 2026, they were going to present America with a leaner, more efficient government and get the budget balanced. And I probably shouldn't have been. I've been around long enough to see enough failed political promises. But for a while, for about two or three months there, I was fairly optimistic that, like, this plan that Elon Musk had laid out to cut $500 billion worth of spending that the government's spending that hasn't even been approved by Congress, and then work with Congress to cut another $1 trillion or $1.5 trillion to actually get the budget balanced. I mean, it was, I knew there'd be a lot of opposition against it, but it seemed like it was the best thing I've ever heard of to actually get this problem fixed. And then, just like 100 days into Trump's administration, he really just fizzled on that. So it's, it does not look like there's really any progress being made on that front. They asked Congress to formalize maybe $10 billion of the Doge cuts, which is nothing compared to the $6 trillion in spending the government does each year. And like I said, now it's pretty much, it seems like Trump's using all the political capital he has to try to get Jerome Powell out of office to lower interest rates to stimulate the economy that way. And he is right that if Jerome Powell resigns next May and you get Scott Bessent or some other MAGA loyalist who just does what Trump tells him and you cut those rates, I mean, it will stimulate the economy and you will see some economic growth, but it will be debt-fueled economic growth, which means the long-term problem's just an order of magnitude bigger.
So obviously there's a very clear and present danger to the United States. What other stories did you have for us today?
Yeah, a couple other big stories in America. Here's one of them, explains why Donald Trump can spend so much money and still be regarded as a conservative, just because his opposition in the Democratic Party is so much worse than he is. They actually, in New York, they had their primary for the Democratic mayor office, not the general election, but just the primary to pick the Democratic candidate. And they picked Zohran Mamdani. Andrew Cuomo bowed out of the race early, so Mamdani won the Democratic primary and looks well poised to become the Democratic mayor of America's largest city in November. He's both a Muslim and a Democratic socialist. So if elected mayor, which will probably happen, he'd be the first millennial mayor of New York, because he's still in his 30s. He'd be the first Muslim mayor of New York. And he'd be the first mayor of New York who's actually a sitting member of the Democratic Socialist of America. There was one mayor who had some affiliation with them back in the 90s, but the first sitting member. So not just a Democrat who espouses socialist parties, but having dual membership in both the Democratic Party and the Democratic Socialist of America, he's talking about having state-run grocery stores, or city-run grocery stores, I guess. So you don't have to go to the Walmart, but like you actually have like New York City runs the grocery store, New York City runs the bus line, defunding the police. Really is radical, like Bernie Sanders, AOC levels of socialism that's really just going to destroy that city. And also surprising for a city New York size to have its first Muslim mayor. I saw a video the other day about all the Muslim mayors in the UK and how disproportionate the number of Muslim mayors is to the percentage of Muslims in the nation. So you might be more used to that than it is here, but here it'd be very spot, because like Muslim, they're just a couple percent of the New York City population. So the fact that there's actually one of them that's going to be running the city, which is the biggest city in the U.S. and arguably the center for, with Wall Street and all that, global capitalism, definitely represents a sizable shift in just the prominence that Islam is having on at least Democratic Party politics here in the United States.
And you could see that even tying into the first story that we were talking about. Like, if New York is governed by a socialist mayor, is that going to, is Frankfurt going to look more alternative, better by comparison, or Basel, or some of these other European financial centers? I imagine, you know, there's different states' rights and law. Like, there's probably only so much a mayor can do to go after the very wealthy living in Manhattan. And I'm sure a lot of the very wealthy that invest in Wall Street don't actually live in Manhattan. So that would limit things somewhat. But when you look at how destructive socialism has been, if you just start to get everything fall apart and be an absolute mess, and New York become more, even more an unpleasant place to be around and do business, could you see this moving? You could see this even helping to move finance towards Europe being the global financial center. Now, you know, Frankfurt, and there's a lot in Europe that's already very socialist. So he would have to shift a long way for that to happen. But you could see that, you could still see that tying in. And I think it is pretty shocking to have a socialist mayor, or close to power. There's talk of Andrew Cuomo running as an independent, and there are a lot of opportunities to stop him still, but to see a socialist mayor at the heart of American capitalism would be a pretty shocking thing. Did you have other stories?
Yeah, a couple other quick ones. Also at the NATO summit this week, I think partially to poke fun at Donald Trump's jabs at Canada for being the 51st state, the EU foreign policy chief actually said that since Canada shares a border with the European Union in the Arctic Ocean, he thought that they might actually have a shot at becoming, instead of the 51st state, but the 28th member of the European Union. I think Mark Carney took that in good humor and clarified that Canada's not currently seeking EU membership, but did something probably just as significant and signed on to the ReArm Europe program. That's a program the European Union is using to give loans to nations to help them get their defense spending up to 3.5% of GDP, like they promised at the NATO summit. So Canada is joining in on that, having some access to those loans. And Carney was very specific that, like, right now, like 70% of Canadian defense spending ends up going to the United States for weapons and stuff like that. So that he really wants to diversify away from the United States and integrate Canada's military more into the European system. So that's another both economic and military story. Just showing how the European Union is rising as an economic and military power with the ability to challenge the United States. I'll end with one last story, maybe a little bit more positive news. Donald Trump, I mean, he was elected on a promise to secure America's southern border. And he hasn't done very well at keeping his campaign promises about the U.S. economy or presenting us with a leaner, more efficient government. But he is making good progress on his border security promises. With the Supreme Court ruling 6-3 this week, six conservative judges against three liberal judges, that the U.S. can deport illegal immigrants to third countries. There had been an issue where some illegal immigrants, they were claiming that they'd been proved to be here illegally, they'd been approved for deportation, but they said, it's like, well, my home country is very dangerous, and I would feel like my life was in danger if you deported me back there. So Donald Trump, he made arrangements to deport them to some other country that wasn't their home country, who was willing to take them. The lower court struck that down, saying that, like, well, you can't deport someone to a country where they're not a citizen. And then the Supreme Court clarified this week that they're like, no, if the third country is willing to take them and they're not citizens here, there's no law against that. So that should open up some more doors for Trump to at least keep some of those campaign promises about deporting all the millions of illegal immigrants, I think probably roughly 10 million illegal immigrants who were caught crossing the border during the Biden administration, back when the government was refusing to enforce its border laws.
Thank you for that, Andrew. I think last week we were talking about a story that seemed to show Russia and China falling out, and Jeremiah got to the bottom of that with us on that show. Now we have a story that shows them very much working together. So to tell us more about that, we'll go now to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. The big story that I wanted to talk about is that Russian officers will soon be training hundreds of Chinese troops on how to apply the lessons, the combat lessons, that Russia has learned during its war against Ukraine. That's the conclusion of a new report that was published this week. It's based on sources in Ukraine's Defense Intelligence Directorate, and it says that approximately 600 Chinese military personnel will be receiving this military training, at least in the first wave, and the training will take place inside of Russia at a range of different bases and military facilities, and the overall focus will be on preparing Chinese soldiers to counter specific Western weapons systems that Russia now has battlefield experience with. And the emphasis is on preparing Chinese artillerymen, engineers, air defense experts, and tank operators. So it's a very high level of training that the Russians will be giving to the Chinese. They'll be sharing all kinds of battlefield insights, very sensitive information. And this shows that China and Russia are remarkably close. You know, as you said a moment ago, we spoke on the show last week about some spy scandals and some hacking scandals showing that Russia and China are secretly mistrustful of each other. And those scandals, I think, are significant, but it doesn't mean that these two nations are not as thick as thieves. They're still extremely close. They're still extremely reliant on each other. And this new report proves that. This shows that they're letting each other into their war rooms. They're disclosing highly confidential intelligence, sharing these highly classified battlefield insights. China will be getting information here that's just invaluable as they prepare their future invasion of Taiwan. You know, they'll be able to study up close Russia's combat experience up against United States HIMARS systems and Patriot missile systems, up against Germany's Leopard 2 tanks and Cobra artillery systems, up against Britain's Storm Shadow missiles and Sea King helicopters. China will be able to study all of those specifics up very close and kind of vicariously adopt the combat experience that Russia has gained from facing off against all of these specific Western weapons systems. So it does show that these two remain very close, despite the mistrust that is there between them. They're still very close. They're still each other's closest allies in some significant ways. And it shows that the Russia-China partnership really remains a defining feature of the modern geopolitical landscape. And really, this should not surprise anyone, because Bible prophecy warned us that this partnership would materialize in the modern era. You can see that in Revelation 16, verse 12. It's all about this massive Asian alliance called the Kings of the East. Ezekiel 38 even shows that Russia will be at the head of this alliance, with China in sort of a secondary position of leadership. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has been sounding the alarm about this Russia-China partnership for many years. And more recently, he's even begun to say that they're already fulfilling the early stages of these prophecies with their partnership. Back in 2014, after China publicly supported Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, Mr. Fleury called that support, quote, a stunning fulfillment of a biblical prophecy. Those were the words that he used. And I'll just read a little bit more of what he wrote at that time. It says, we've been proclaiming for over 50 years that Russia, China, and other Asian nations would ally themselves in the end time. And we are in that end time now. When these Asian nations, extremely powerful nuclear-armed countries, begin to show solidarity with each other regarding moves like that, what does that portend for the world? I tell you, it is woe to the world. It will cause many serious problems. End quote. So that was in 2014 when Mr. Fleury wrote that. And now here we are about a decade on from there. And the support that Russia and China are giving to each other is now much deeper, much more significant. And it's plain now for most anyone to see that this is woe to the world. It is fueling wars, and it is causing serious problems, just as he wrote. And if anyone would like to better understand the role that the Russia-China axis will play in end-time events, I hope that you'll order a copy of our free booklet that's all about this. It's called Russia and China in Prophecy.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah, for that very clear demonstration of these two powers working together. I think you had another story about Asian powers coming together, and then a beach resort that I'm quite intrigued to hear more about.
Yes. Yeah. So first up is just a story about Russia and Indonesia. On Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin had a meeting with his Indonesian counterpart, and they signed a whole raft of military cooperation agreements. They'll be boosting their cooperation in combat training, ship calls to port, and even in developing military technology together. So they'll be really drawing much closer. And this is a noteworthy development for Russian power, because Indonesia is not an insignificant nation by any means. This is the world's fourth most populous country. It has the 13th most powerful military, according to the latest Global Firepower Index. So Indonesia is powerful, and it has the capacity to become much more powerful than it even is. So we could see this nation become a very important military ally for Russia in a way that significantly boosts Russian power. So this is really another story showing the kings of the East coming together in a dramatic way there. And then I wanted to end with a story about North Korea. They made a lot of headlines this week for announcing that they're building not a new nuclear weapon, not a new hypersonic missile, but a new beach resort. That was not on my bingo card for 2025. I don't think very many Pyongyang watchers really expected this, because North Korea is normally just hyper-focused on military matters. It's normally very secretive, very closed off from the rest of the world. But now, suddenly, Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un is expecting a bit of a tourism boom. I'm not sure exactly why he's expecting that, but he is now converting a missile testing site on Wonsan Kalma Beach into a beach resort. And it actually opens up on July 1st. So if anyone is looking for a last minute getaway spot that's a place kind of off the beaten tourist path, you might want to keep this North Korean resort in mind.
And maybe we can persuade you to do an on location spot from there one of these days.
Yeah, after some of the things that I've written about the North Korean regime, I don't know if it would be wise for me to take the risk.
we'll threaten to send them to North Korea. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah, and to all of our panelists. We do not intend to send any one of you to North Korea. Thank you very much to Georgia Dad and Victor Granados for engineering and production on today's show. If you have any questions, any comments, if you need a hand ordering the literature or subscribing to the Trumpet magazine, you can get in touch with us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'll be back with our regular show on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.